The Escoffier series continues with Chapter 13, Vegetables and Farinaceous Products. Now, we covered mushrooms on the last episode, and, well, that was enjoyable. In my neck of the woods, folks are already finding morels. Do you forage for mushrooms? It's about that time almost everywhere here in the contiguous 48. But there is more to cover than just mushrooms in our vegetable chapter, so join me as we continue on our merry way. The Eating Liberty Podcast, episode 285, Food and Freedom, once a week for life. Hello, folks. Dan Reed here. Welcome back to the show. I've been a chef and a baker for many years. Chefs do many jobs, including recipe development. In many cases, at least for myself, making a new recipe starts with using an old one. That's where Escoffier comes in. Using his guidance, we can create new ways with familiar foods. So, as I said, the Escoffier series is continuing. We're moving through Chapter 13 a little bit more slowly than I had expected, but that's okay. I think last episode of this, I teased about using escarole, which is in the chicory family, with a salmon dish. Now, escarole is a key to an Italian wedding soup. I mean, a good Italian wedding soup. You could use spinach, but why would you do that? There's a reason, of course. I find it, the escarole, a touch bitter, which is a feature since I like bitter. The chicory family includes the salad green frisée, which was much loved by chefs, especially back in the late 80s, early 90s. It was all the rage. And it's still kind of fun. It looks fun on the plate. As well as Belgian endive, which isn't a chicory at all, and escarole, which is a chicory. Belgian endive is a variety of radicchio, and all of them, radicchio and endive, are related to the dandelion. One slightly interesting thing about the Belgian endive and the why it is white has the same basic reason that white asparagus is white. The Belgian endive is grown in the dark, and white asparagus, they keep moving the dirt up. And possibly they grow it in the dark now, but it's deprived of sunlight, which never allows the... suddenly my basic bio is escaping me. Photosynthesis isn't allowed to take place. All right, enough of that. That's too much complicated. That salmon dish I mentioned had a grilled portion of salmon served on top of sautéed escarole next to creamed corn. Now, that sweet, creamy, rich corn against the bitter, garlicky escarole with the fatty, rich salmon was a, man, was it good. Just, it was fun to invent. It was fantastic to eat. So, escarole should be washed, and very well. It can be pretty sandy, especially down by the root. Then cut it into somewhat large pieces, 2 inches or so, and then blanch it. The blanching will remove some of the bitterness, but also it facilitates a faster sautéing. Now, that was for restaurant line service, because everything has to be fast. At home, I would do the same thing. The stems are quite thick, and the blanching helps soften them. It breaks those cell walls down, which is what the heat's going to do. It makes the sautéing part happen a little bit faster and also allows for heating without coloring. Now, I'm not opposed to coloring green vegetables, which we'll talk about in a little bit, but in this case, I didn't want the brown. The blanched escarole leaves are wet. That's a duh moment. That's important to know when you add it to a hot pan. It's going to spit. Butter or animal fat in the hot pan, escarole next, and then the garlic. Now, garlic will burn if you put it in the pan first. And so depending on how, depends on a few things, how much fat you have, how hot the pan is, how much escarole you have, how thick or thin it's actually cut. The garlic goes in, if you only want light garlic flavor, put it in when escarole is almost nearly completely heated throughout. If you want a little bit more oomph on your garlic, add it a little bit before. But of course, if it gets close to burn, no matter what happens, the pan's done. Adjust the seasoning and you have a fine side dish. You could render some bacon and then add the escarole to that. And then continue cooking as we just described, and then it might actually be a little bit better. Slowly cook some chicken thighs, fat side down, really slow to make them really crisp, and then that's a fine protein addition to that escarole. Now, another reason to blanch greens, spinach is a green, and escarole and lettuce, we're going to get to that part, is to remove the water from the vegetable before it's cooked. Now, if you've ever cooked spinach, and we've talked about this before, there's memes going around that they show 8 leaves of cooked spinach on a plate and say this represents 15 boxes of spinach. It's only partly, mostly true. It's spinach shrinks a lot. There's a lot of water in it. So that's one reason, is to get that excess water out of the spinach or out of the escarole before it goes in the pan, meaning we could do cook a little bit faster and it isn't just sort of literally stewing, as Coffee would call it, braising in its own juices. Creamed escarole is quite dandy. Now, Escoffier offers a procedure with brown roux and stock, and I just don't think that's necessary. Blanch the escarole as before, remove it to a pot, and add heavy cream, just enough to cover, and it won't take very much because the escarole is going to sort of sink way down because we've blanched it to take away some of its structure, and then add 2 cloves of garlic or 4 cloves of garlic depending on how much you like garlic. Cook that until the cream becomes thick. So several things will happen. The water in the cream will come out. As the cream is cooking the escarole in the juice, in the cream, it's going to also pull water out. But at some point, that's going to stop, and the cream will do what is expected to do, which means the water comes out, the butterfat remains, and it gets thick. And that's why a cream sauce works. And so we make this creamed escarole with garlic, and it's like, wow, that's really good. You could do the same thing with Swiss chard, rainbow Swiss chard. It's just good. Just good on a cold day, and I just saw it hailing a minute ago. So adjust the seasoning to that, and you have a nice small bowl as a side, or a big bowl. Most of us think of Belgian endive as a salad ingredient, cut into little half moons, or as a vessel for appetizers, little pipes, this thing or another, cream cheese with caviar. Belgian endive can be cooked. I worked with a chef who spent some time in Belgium and made the most amazing casserole of Belgian endive with ham and cream and Gruyere cheese. Now, I'm not sure if they invented that, but those two things may be just correlation. Instead of blanching, Escoffier writes, the endive should be placed tightly in one layer in a non-reactive pan, stainless steel would be fine, covered with salted lemon water and a few pats of butter. Cover that whole thing with buttered parchment and then foil or the pan's lid, and cook slowly for about half an hour or until the endive are tender at the root end. Now, variations to that would include cooking them in stock without the acid and keeping the butter. You could add bacon fat, duck fat, chicken fat, or all of it, covered and cooked until done. That remains. Remove the endive, reduce the liquid to it's nice and thick so it drapes, and then pour that on the endive. You could add diced ham at the midpoint of the cooking, and then as that reduces, the ham flavor becomes predominant in the glaze that's going on top of the endive. That big pot, well, might be more than you want to make, and endive isn't particularly cheap. So it's easy to take that whole idea of a big pan worth of endive and make it enough for two, enough for one. So you've got little cocotte dishes. Well, what the heck is that? Creme brulee often is served, well, sometimes it's in a big ramekin. That probably wouldn't work because the ramekins I have are not large enough. They are too narrow. The endive are usually longer than the width of the little ramekins, but oval-shaped dishes or something that's oven-proof that would hold the endive, then that would be ideal. And then the same thing applies. A little bit of sauce. If you're poaching in the oven, just change to a smaller container. Cabbage is next. Now, more than likely, you made a face just now. I suspect most people don't care for cabbage, and most people probably have only ever had it boiled, which is bland and boring. Two words that mean the same thing. Cabbage is excellent as sauerkraut. In fact, it may be the only thing to make sauerkraut. Oh, by the way, kimchi. Cabbage can also be braised or pickled, which opens up a lot of options. Now, of course, you know the red cabbage and the light green cabbage, which looks almost exactly like white cabbage. If you happen to be Polish or Eastern European, you might remember Granny with those giant cabbage heads when she made gwomki. You know, it's the old Proust paragraph, and I've talked about it before, and that little, the end of Ratatouille where Ego eats the ratatouille and transported, not really, you know, to being 4 years old at Nana's kitchen back door. I can still smell the smell of gwomki in Grandma's kitchen. It's just, you know, sometimes some smells, some memories, they feel like just warm hugs. It's just, when Grandma cooked, it was great. It was awesome. Cabbage is in the brassica family, and brassica is by far the largest family of vegetables. It includes, but not totally, cauliflower, broccoli, Brussels sprouts, and various other cabbages such as napa and bok choy, kale, turnips, collard greens, kohlrabi, and I'm sure there's more. Now, I eat cabbage in some form nearly every day for breakfast. Caramelized is my preferred way. It's not an escoffier method. It's one I borrowed from our keto friend, Jimmy Clegg, who I'm pretty sure borrowed it from his wife. It's easy enough to make. Dice some bacon. Render that. At about the halfway point of it being done, add diced cabbage. Now, cook low and slow until the cabbage is literally browned. I mean, caramelized. Stirring now and again, adjust the seasoning and eat. Now, here's the thing. And when you get at the core and the core itself, the leaves down at the bottom near the core have really thick veins, as opposed to the very tip top where it's just the thin leaf. Those two aren't going to cook the same time. So when I'm cutting my cabbage for caramelized cabbage, at the really thick stem parts, I either cut them in half lengthwise to make the cooking faster, or cut all of that really white, heavy, thick stuff very, very thin and leave the thin, sort of, by contrast, delicate cabbage leaves at the top, leave those bigger because they're going to cook a lot faster. And the amount of time it takes for the caramelized cabbage to cook all the way, it may not make a difference, but there is also the end result of how does it eat? What is the mouthfeel? How does it fit on the fork? All this kind of goes into play to why I do that the way that I do it. But it is a great part of my breakfast, and it's quite honestly, I look forward to it every day. Red cabbage makes excellent braised cabbage, which pairs with venison or wild boar quite nicely. Escoffier offers a version of red cabbage which would go well also with those two or any other gamey meat. Ostrich isn't gamey and would go well with red cabbage. Ostrich is, it's crazy to say because it's a bird, it's beefy. It's beefier than most beef you'll ever have. Antelope, which I think, unless you're a hunter, most antelope and elk that you would buy online or in a, well, I'm not sure if you can get it in a grocery store or a butcher shop, but anyway, that you would buy online, nearly all that is going to be farm raised, which has an advantage. One is that we can get it, and two, it comes with at least some level of certainty that it is wholesome, as opposed to Cousin Frank, who went out and shot something, although I probably would trust Cousin Frank. But anyway, those other meats are available online. Antelope's fantastic. So the red cabbage a la Limousin, was spelled limousine, and I probably destroyed the pronunciation, is simply julienne red cabbage seasoned, avoid the core, more about that in a moment, cover with a light stock, chicken perhaps, pork drippings, and whole raw chestnuts. He writes 20 chestnuts per head of cabbage. So the first challenge is, where do you get raw chestnuts at all, or certainly in the spring? Canned chestnuts would work. Just add them at the halfway process of the cooking. In this, so this thing, we're going to cook all that. So we want the chestnut flavor. Raw will need time to cook. And chestnuts never get, like a potato will cook down to next to nothingness. I've never cooked a chestnut long enough that happens. And they always retain their identity. They still have a toothsome isn't really the word, but they have a little bit of a texture, and they certainly have a flavor, which I like. And the combination of the red cabbage and the chestnut really is a good combination. And let that stock cook everything down nice and fine, and take the cover off to let it get kind of a glaze, and that's a good eating. If that's more than you wish to deal with, this one's a little bit easier. A few more ingredients. It's a braised red cabbage you can make. Now, the ratios aren't set in stone. In fact, I'm adjusting them as I read from the 7.5 pounds of cabbage this recipe uses. So, paring it down by about a third, this is a rough guess, a quarter of a red onion, diced or julienne, whatever you like in your final outcome, half of a red apple diced, variety doesn't matter, peeled is my preference, one piece of bacon diced, one head of red cabbage julienne, quarter of a cup of red vinegar, quarter of a cup of red wine, the drier the better, quarter of a cup of sugar, or one tablespoon of honey. Now, that's not a baking equivalent. That's just a sweet equivalent, flavor-wise, not baking-wise. 1 ounce of red currant jelly, or whatever jelly you have on hand, and a sachet of cinnamon stick, juniper berries, and a bay leaf. Bring to the bacon. Add the sugar or honey. When that melts or spreads out, add the onion, apple, and the cabbage. Season with salt and stir, and as that cooks down, add the sachet of spices, the jelly, and the liquids. Now, the liquids may, if the pan's a little warm, the boiling vinegar is going to make a bit of an acid, so keep your face away because it tickles your nose. Bring that to a boil, reduce to a simmer, and cook until the juice is nearly reduced and the cabbage is tender. Remove the sachet. Double check the seasoning, and you're good to go. It isn't included here that raisins are a good addition, and they are. Dried currants would be better. So you can get kind of funky. You could add dried strawberries to this. I think that would be sweeter than I would prefer, but it's sort of consistent with adding the dry fruit to the thing. There's just, as you like things, sage might work better than rosemary. Thyme would be nice. Savory would be good. So you can add things to this. You can make it your own. Omit things if you don't want to take the jelly out entirely. I don't like this one to be too sweet. I want more of the acid coming out, because the acid part going with a rich game meat really does has a nice contrast, and too much sweet is going to get in the way of that for my palate. Now, escoffier, I meant to say also, the braised red cabbage would be spectacular with sauerbraten. Escoffier has a very short entry for the various leaves of other cabbage family items. Broccoli leaves, kohlrabi leaves, and turnip leaves he identified, as well as scotch kale. Now, I don't know what the difference is between scotch kale and the toilet paper stuff we buy in the store, but he writes, quote, all of these different leaves may be prepared a l'anglaise, i.e. boiled in salted water, or cooked with butter as for Brussels sprouts. These are the only suitable methods of cooking, end quote. Now, I've included that because I found humor in the suggestion that kale can only be cooked one way. I personally think that's one too many. Broccoli, cauliflower, and Brussels sprouts will have to wait. Some procedures for cauliflower really do merit some time to go through, and partly because even though there's a couple of steps involved, they really are good. And it's uncommon to do them, so it would be, you know, for a nice meal. But man, really, really fun stuff. Good stuff to eat. Now, before I end, I said I would get back to the cabbage core. Jack Shoup, certified master chef, was endlessly curious about food. Now, one day, we were cutting the cores out of cabbage, making something, and he grabbed one hunk, salted it, and started nibbling small little bites like Tom Hanks eating the baby corns in the movie Big. Well, Jack was very animated when he got excited and almost yelled how good this was. Salted cabbage cores was the new treat. I don't eat them raw, and I don't throw them away. I cut them out and then cut them very thin, just like I cut down at the base with that thick stems, the veins, so they cook faster and everybody sort of cooks at the same time. And by the time they get caramelized, the cabbage core is just as tender as everything else. The point of the story is twofold. Be curious. Eat something different. And find joy in the simplest of things. All right, folks, that's going to do it. The text from this episode will be on the show notes page, culinarylibertarian.com/285. Have a good week. I hope it's not hailing where you are, and I'll see you soon. Music for the Culinary Libertarian podcast is provided by Matthew Bankert at mattbankert.com.